Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
Friday on the Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting worldwide on Sports360AZ.com and AZ Central Sports. My name is Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad Sessmatt today and joined by AZ Central Sports columnist Paula Bovin. The two of us, our second go at this week, but this is the first time together, so it's nice to be joined by you today.
Good to be here, Jared.
Paula has an incredible column up about the situation surrounding Brittany Griner, the Phoenix Mercury star who was in the news for the wrong reasons yesterday. We'll get into that in a moment. There's a lot of more positive news going around in the world of sports that we'll get to. And those stories, the top stories for this hour, are brought to you by the Honda Resort and Casino, which is located in the beautiful White Mountains just outside of Pine Top in eastern Arizona. Head on up now. Enjoy the beautiful spring weather and stay at the Honda Resort and Casino. Before we get into basketball, breaking news on the ASU front. So they have a new swim coach, and it's a familiar name. Bob Bowman, who is the long-known, long-time trainer of Michael Phelps, the most decorated swimmer in world's Olympic history, is now the head coach for ASU swimming. Kind of an interesting story as we get started here on a Friday.
Yeah, and I think our writer Jeff Metcalf just posted it on AZ Central if you want more details. But this is kind of the era of Ray Anderson where I think he's trying to make splashy hires. Obviously, he wants the right kind of people. But this is how you tend to measure ADs, is the coaches that they hire. And, at least for the beginning, this looks like a great one for the swim program.
There's definitely a trend with Ray Anderson. You look at Tracy Smith. He hired his first hire at the baseball coach. If you've gotten a chance to interact with him, he's great. Right. Very energetic, funny, different, brings a vibe.
Absolutely.
Then you look at Bobby Hurley. I think it's safe to say he brings a vibe just based on name recognition alone, plus to see what he's done over the last 2 years. And then you look at Bob Bowman, who's long known as a dynamo in the swimming world based on, training Michael Phelps, among others. So there's definitely something to that of what Ray Anderson is trying to accomplish, where these guys are successful in what they do, but their name recognition creates a buzz and an intrigue to maybe areas or sports, especially at ASU, that may not get it on a regular basis.
No, absolutely. And that's the kind of thing I think they want to do, where the kind of the place where their athletic program is. And it's interesting. I just didn't know when Ray was hired what his MO was going to be. Was it going to be about fundraising? Was it going to be about hiring coaches? And for now, at least, it's about the guys he's putting under him in the athletic department.
That's Paula Bovin. I'm Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad today. Now to the NBA playoffs. And if you don't know who Steph Curry is, I don't know where you've been living over the last several years, and especially over this past year. He has been unbelievable this season and again in the playoffs thus far, as the Golden State Warriors take a 3-0 lead on the New Orleans Pelicans, 123-119 in overtime. 40 points last night, including a last-second dagger to send it into overtime.
Can the Warriors steal this? Let's find out. Green will throw it in. Curry comes to the ball, goes to the corner, catches, works up Pondexter, fade away, three, short, rebound Spates, Curry in the corner, shoots, on the way, got it! He hit it! 2.8 to go! He got clobbered as well! Holiday to throw it in, Tyreek Evans from midcourt, shoots, good if it goes, no good! We're going to overtime!
Great call, Warriors radio broadcast right there. Steph Curry, the Warriors trailed by 17 with 6 minutes left, as much as 20 in the fourth quarter, and Steph Curry does his thing. 10 of 29 from the field, 7 of 18 from three, 40 points, 9 assists, 5 rebounds, a partridge and a pear tree.
Oh, my gosh. I think the Warriors scored 54 points, if I read the right, in fourth quarter and in overtime. They were just on a roll, but guys like him just fascinate me. Watching all this college basketball, I know you do too, Jared,
yes.
The NBA, there's certain guys who rise to the occasion and they're clutch performance. And I don't know where it comes from, if it's something you're born with, if it's just the repetition of playing basketball. But there's millions of great basketball players out there who can't hit that shot. He is one of those guys that just rises to the occasion. And I'm fascinated by the mentality of these guys.
It's pretty incredible. And you think about this. The Warriors, as mentioned, were down by as much as 20 in the fourth quarter. But I like to look at the plus minus to get an idea of how a game is unfolded. Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. Klay Thompson was a plus 18, and Steph Curry was a plus 13. And there's a couple other guys that were big pluses. Leandro Barbosa, unfortunately for him, in 11 minutes played, was a minus 12. That's neither here nor there.
Right.
But you look at how much of a factor those guys are, and how much of a game changer those guys are. And when you see a Steph Curry at a plus 13 with 40 points in 43 minutes played, and to think that they were down by 20 at one point, that doesn't seem like it adds up or makes sense.
No, like it won't translate to a victory. So impressed by that performance, and just, you know, and credit to that staff. You have to convince players that they can do that. When you're down 17 with 6 minutes, there has to be some kind of vibe in those timeout huddles that everyone believes 17 is easy to overcome. And that's exactly what happened with this group. And I can't even believe there was ever a debate about MVP after this game. I mean, it seems clear cut for him now.
Definitely. Well, we talk about, you mentioned what mentality he must have and how many don't. Steph Curry, after the game, talked about and described the shot at the end of the game and the reaction after the fact.
Mo Spates made a huge play to get that rebound, had the wherewithal and composure to grab it, take a dribble, figure out what was going on, and he saw me relocate to the corner and knew I had a few seconds to get the shot off, and thankfully he got it off quick enough before those two guys, you know, clobbered me, and was able to knock it down.
It should have been a 4-point play opportunity to win the game and not to send it to overtime. He makes a good point. Maurice Spates, I'm sure you saw the highlights. That was a phenomenal play, too, that he made.
No question.
And perfect position to get that rebound. You know, once you get right off the rim like that, that's a tough bounce to make a play. But that's Steph Curry talking about the shot after the game.
And those are those moments where, you know, you grab a rebound and maybe it shows up in the stat line, but you're not necessarily celebrated for that. But this one, I mean, that had such an impact on the game.
No question. Steve Kerr after the game, this is just a special group of players, this Warriors team.
Well, we have something special with our team. They're never out of the fight. They have great confidence. Sometimes too much confidence. That's probably what got us in trouble in the first place.
That's a good point. And how much? It's really hard being a local sports fan here. You know, it has nothing to do with the Warriors, but it's hard to not root for this coaching staff when you see Steve Kerr, Alvin Gentry, Luke Walton. You know, a lot of familiar faces in this state that are doing an excellent job around a very fun team to watch.
And solid guys. I mean, we cover a lot of administrators and coaches and GMs. These guys all have pretty impeccable reputations, and so it's great to see where they're going. And I was watching that game last night thinking, what if he had taken that Knicks job? Because for a while, everybody thought that was a done deal, his relationship with Phil Jackson. What if Steve Kerr had gone that direction? He clearly knew what he was doing.
Clearly. So, as mentioned, Warriors 3-0 lead. The Cavs also took a 3-0 lead over the Celtics last night, even though the Celtics are another team that's pretty fun to watch. And Isaiah Thomas has just been a monster for them since he was traded. It's probably one of the best things to ever happen to him that the Suns dealt him during the trade deadline.
Good fit for him. Absolutely.
And then some big games tonight, including the Spurs and Clippers game 3. That's the late one. And Houston can go for the jugular a little bit against Dallas. Dallas is in an absolute mess right now. And also Toronto and Washington in action. That's tonight. The Spurs-Clippers game, though, is what I will be focusing on.
Be great.
Because as much as everyone was excited about how the Clippers looked in game 1, it's exactly what Popovich wanted. I firmly believe that. We know we're going to split probably on the road, so why not get blown out and made look stupid in game 1 to send a message to my team and then get that split?
That's it's total Popovich. Yep. No question.
In a nutshell. Paul, I want to switch gears. Still talking about basketball, but not as much of a fun and exciting aspect. You wrote a fantastic column on AZ Central Sports about Brittany Griner and an angle around the situation with her and the domestic fight that she had with her fiance Glory Johnson. That was a big story yesterday, but you took a extremely different approach on it, an approach that I feel very few in this industry would take. I know I wouldn't go there, but you did, and it was phenomenal, talking about the issue of same-sex domestic violence and how the numbers are just absolutely way ahead of what you see from opposite gender relations. I don't know if that's the right way to put it.
Yeah, I know that language is tough in this whole situation.
Yeah, totally. But it creates a topic and an issue at a time where it needs to be talked about. I was wondering if you could just go a little bit more in depth about you spent a lot of time on this, that your focus on this, and why it's such an important issue to be talked about.
Well, a couple things. After it happened, a couple things jumped in my mind. And one, I've written a lot of Brittany Griner, you know, since she's come here. There was a lot of excitement. I kind of hosted a book tour thing she was doing, a book signing, and I've been fascinated by her and very positive stuff, and I enjoyed writing it. But I felt in this era of equality, you know, where we're trying to get everything, the equal treatment of men and women in sports, it would have been unfair not to cover this story. And that's what the media has kind of avoided, these sort of same-sex domestic violence issue, because we're uncomfortable with it. And it's a topic that's hard for people to talk about. So that came into my mind. But also the reality is it's a story that needs to be told, because especially with the WNBA, there have been many players now comfortable talking about their sexuality, very open about it. But we're going to start seeing this in other sports. We've seen even, you know, men talking about it, that same-sex relationship. So there's going to be these storylines. And the fact is the numbers are staggering when it comes to issues about domestic violence and same-sex relationships. And I don't know if teams have addressed it. I think the WNBA needs to come forward, talk about it, address it, educate its players. And I just felt it was a time to bring it up. And that's kind of where I headed with it.
And you mentioned that the WNBA has long been kind of innovative as it pertains to handling, you know, kind of social issues.
Sure.
And being at the forefront on various topics. But you just kind of... You you alluded to it a little bit, that they need to be take a step forward and kind of take for the good and the bad. Mm-hmm. Look at what the NFL has done in the situation surrounding Ray Rice and Greg Hardy and the domestic violence issues there as well.
Yeah, I mean, we saw what happened in the NFL. The NFL took some really hard hits for good reasons, because they did not address those situations quickly. They did not seem like they cared enough about it. Now they've come a long way. They've got, you know, organizations within the NFL that are studying it, and they're doing a lot for domestic abuse, and it's great. But the WNBA I think they need to come forward. They've been very quiet even since this happened. I understand due process and all that stuff, but bottom line is this is an issue. It's probably going to come up again. It's happened even before this Griner situation, and I'd like to see them be vocal about it. Let's get it out in the open and then move on.
That's Paula Bovin of AZ Central Sports. Again, highly recommend the column she wrote about Brittany Griner and the same-sex domestic violence topic. It's fascinating. It's a great read. Highly recommend it. Coming up next, we're going to be joined by a former Sun and former Pac-12 great to talk about the Suns and maybe a little Pac-12 hoops. Casey Jacobson joining the show. It's coming up next. That's AZ Central Sports. It's Paula Bovin. I'm Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad Sesmat on a Friday on Sports360AZ.com.
Like our Facebook fan page for unique Arizona sports content from the high schools to the pros. Facebook.com/Sports360AZ.
Friday on the Brad Sesmat Show. I'm Jared Cohen. That's Paula Bovin filling in for Brad today. And hey, the fun fact, 30 years ago today, Michael Jordan hit his first ever playoff game winner. And we are joined now by someone who is very familiar with hitting game winners, especially his time at Stanford, especially if you're a Duke and Arizona fan. You remember that pretty well. Casey Jacobson joins us on the show. And as we're talking about game winners or game tires, how can you comprehend what Steph Curry was able to do last night in New Orleans?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, Jared and Paul, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on the radio with you guys. That was one of the best playoff performances at the end of the game that I have seen in a really long time. And Steph Curry has played MVP caliber basketball this entire season. Whether the award goes to Harden or Curry, it doesn't matter. But he is growing his legend right now. Steph Curry is in the prime of his career. And you know how when you watch players it can be about something besides basketball, like watching a movie or reading a book, and you watch it or read it, and you just know that it's the best you've ever seen, and you don't have to consult the experts. I don't need to look at stats to know that when I watch Steph Curry shoot the basketball, I have never seen anybody shoot it at the clip that he does in pressure moments like he does.
We were talking earlier, Casey. I'm so amazed by guys who are just clutch players, who take the shot, who make the shot frequently. And I'm wondering where you think that comes from. Is it guys just through repetition? Is it guys who have more confidence than others? Why are some guys clutch players in that regard?
Well, one of the most important things that a shooter can have is confidence. However, in order to get real confidence, that comes through hours. Like, we're talking hundreds of thousands of hours of practice. You can't fake confidence. Like, when I work with other young people and they ask me, like, try to break down their shot and help them, and they're not confident, I can't just say magic words. I can't just sprinkle a magic potion on their head and all of a sudden they have confidence. Steph Curry is the son of Dale Curry,
yeah.
A 16-year NBA veteran. He's got the DNA. He's got the toughness. He has been bred for these types of moments. But let's not forget the fact that this guy has an unusual drive and a desire to work on his craft every day. I've watched a lot of videos on him. And if you ever go to a game early for the Warriors and watch, he shows up 2 hours before the game. He is working on ball handling, hand-eye coordination, and shots. So it's not an accident that he performs at this high level.
Former Stanford star and Suns guard, now with Fox Sports 1 and the Pac-12 Network, Casey Jacobson joining us on the Brad Sesmatt Show. And Casey, you talk about the it factor, and some guys just have it, but you know how to shoot a basketball as well as anyone. What about his shot makes it so perfect from just a fundamental standpoint from what you can see?
Well, he has a quick release. So, you know, to me, you don't have to have picture-perfect form like Ray Allen or Steve Nash. Those are guys that and Steph Curry I would put out there. He has picture-perfect form. But there's been other guys that have quote-unquote ugly shots like Larry Bird and Reggie Miller. They're not, you know, textbook. I wouldn't teach the way that they shoot to young people. But what Steph Curry does is he is able to get his shot in the shooting pocket, which is the shooting pocket is above your waist and right in front of your face. So to be able to shoot at a consistently high level, you have to have a quick release, a shot that can be duplicated over and over and over, whether it's off the catch, off the dribble, or, you know, turning and off the move. And that's why, to me, he's able to get shots off against anybody, because he can get the ball into that shooting pocket quickly, and his release is the same every time. And that goes back to what I was talking about before, hours and hours of practice.
Casey, I remember, and particularly I think at Stanford, you were not afraid to shoot from way beyond the three-point line. You were not afraid of distance. I always wondered where that came from with you.
Well, one of the reasons where that came from was ego. I wanted to prove that I could be, you know, one of the best deep shooters. But the other thing is, the more success I had at an early age, we're talking like high school, the harder it was for me to get shots. And what I realized is guys don't want to guard you 23, 24 feet away from the basket. They can guard you 18, 19, and 20 feet from the basket. That's easy. But guys don't want to make that extra effort to close out. And I found out that if I can shoot a consistently efficient shot from 22 or 23 feet, I'm going to be open, because my defender is going to have to help out, whether it be on drives from other guys or post passes from bigs. And that closeout becomes extra long if you have deep range.
Interesting stuff. Casey Jacobson joining us, former Stanford star and Suns guard. Let's talk about a little more local here now. You were around the Suns quite a bit this season, doing some work on the pre and post game shows. And I'm curious, you know, the direction that you see this team needing to go. What are key pieces they needed to add? What are great things they have in place? Just there's so many questions. A lot of people think they're going to be just as active, if not more active, than they were at the NBA trade deadline, which is a little bit of a scary thought. But just curious your thoughts from being around the team this season and what you see going forward.
Well, you know, this was a season to forget, I think, for Suns fans on and off the court. It started with, you know, some off-the-court stuff that, of course, you know, was hard. P.J. Tucker got off to a bad start where he got suspended for DUI and was, you know, suspended for the first couple games. And it's finishing still with this Morris Brothers situation, this felony assault thing, and, you know, everything in between. So, you know, what was interesting to start the Suns season was their three-point guard experiment. And it was very interesting, and a lot of times it was fun to watch, but it ultimately failed. And I actually, you guys know that I live in Los Angeles, and I went to the Suns, I think it was their fourth or fifth game of the season, at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. And I saw the writing on the wall in that game. Eric Bledsoe, his body language was horrible. And they ended up winning that game against a bad Lakers team, And, you know, Dragic had a good game, and Isaiah Thomas came off the bench, had a good game. But what I realized, you guys, was that three point guards, one of them is always going to be unhappy or upset. It's very rare that all three of them are going to get playing time, shots, and all the things that they want. You know, and the point guard position is the most important. So that's what, you know, kind of led to the downfall of this team that year. They also had a lack of discipline. They led the league in technical fouls, and they had a lack of leadership. You know, Eric Bledsoe is a very good player, but I don't think he's a alpha dog leader, a guy that, you know, guys can lean on. So having said all that, going into the summer, I wouldn't be surprised if the Suns are the most active. They have a lot of work to do. I don't know if they want to keep Eric Bledsoe, trade him. He's very talented. A lot of teams could use a guy like that. Are they going to sign Brandon Knight to a long-term deal, even after only seeing him for 11 games? Is Alex Len the guy that they want to move forward with at the front court position? A lot of unanswered questions, guys.
Casey, throughout your career, college, NBA, international career, when you look at the coaches that you thought worked and were successful, what's the common trait? And I'm asking this because about Jeff Hornacek. I thought he was a great hire. He clearly knows what he's doing. Does it matter what kind of a demeanor you have as a coach? I'm just curious from your past experiences, what's been successful?
Well, there is not one, you know, way to do it. There really isn't one way to coach a basketball team, because every single team has different personalities, different players. They're all different ages and in different stages of their career. Now, I played for Mike D'Antoni for 2 years in Phoenix. And a lot of people, you know, complain that his demeanor was too, you know, laissez-faire. He was a player's coach, and he didn't, you know, demand defense enough. But if I recall, those teams were very successful and one or two games away from making the NBA Finals. And I loved playing for Coach D'Antoni. And I played for other coaches who were more demanding. I played for Jeff Van Gundy. I played for Byron Scott. And we weren't as successful. Now, is that because of their demeanor, or was it because of the players, or a little bit of a combination of both? Now, to go back to your first question, Jeff Hornacek is an excellent coach, and I like his demeanor. However, this team's personality didn't match his, and it quickly got away from him, and he had problems that he really couldn't solve. Plus, they didn't have leadership. You got to have a guy that is an extension of your coach. For D'Antoni, it was Steve Nash. That relationship worked really, really well. And for Phil Jackson, you know, when he had Derek Fisher, it wasn't even Kobe Bryant. Kobe Bryant was their best player, but Derek Fisher was the leader, the extension of the coach. Mm-hmm. This Suns team didn't have that.
That's very interesting stuff. Casey Jacobson joining us, the former Stanford star, now with Fox Sports 1, and also the Pac-12 Network. And we'll shift gears now to the Pac-12. You saw a lot of Stanley Johnson and Arizona Wildcats basketball. He decides that he declares for the NBA just yesterday evening. Your thoughts on Stanley? Is this the right decision for him? What do you think was going through his mind to why he kind of took a little bit of time? And how do you see him fitting at the next level?
Well, first of all, this is always an individual decision. I could never judge somebody whether or not they wanted to pursue their dream, whether it be the NBA or the NFL or whatever it is.
Sure.
And also, you know, at Stanford, I left early after my junior year to pursue my dream. So, you know, if Stanley wants to do that after his freshman year, I'm happy for him. Now, having said that, I do think it's the right decision, because I believe that timing is just as important as anything else that we can talk about. His skill set or where he's going, timing. If you're going to be a top 10 pick, that's a lot of money to turn down. To return to Arizona, you could possibly get injured. If your stock doesn't go up, you can possibly lose that on millions of dollars. And let's be honest, that's a lot. I mean, I don't know a ton about Stanley's background and where he comes from, but, you know, that's tough to turn down. So if I were him, I'd be coming out as well. I'm not sure why he waited so long, because I knew all along that Stanley was going to be a top 10 pick. You know, it was just only a matter of time. It was inevitable. I like his game. I do think he translates well to the NBA, because the best thing that he does is physically overwhelm people, and he can and will do that at the NBA level, even though the guys that he played against at Arizona are going to be, you know, a lot bigger and stronger at the NBA level. He is ready physically, which is, you know, half the battle. I would say that 75% of the guys that are going to get drafted are not physically ready for the NBA. Their skill set might be ready, and they do certain things well, but Stanley Johnson is in that rare category where physically he's not going to have to worry. He has a lot to work on as far as his ball handling ability and his three-point shooting. Teams are going to guard way off him and make him continue to make outside jumpers.
And it sounds like Arizona, Casey, got some good news today that Caleb Tarzewski is going to stick around for another year. I know there are some people who thought maybe he didn't rise to the level of play he could have this season. What do you think about him, his game, and do you think there's a benefit for him to sticking around another year?
Absolutely. Caleb, you know, put up some pedestrian numbers, and not all of that is his fault.
Right.
You know, he played on a loaded team, and he was like the fifth or sometimes even the sixth option on that team. So, of course, his scoring numbers aren't going to be, you know, they're not going to overwhelm you. But he is a guy that really needs another year of college. His offensive post game is still very raw. He's athletically like Stanley Johnson. He's ready for the next level, but his skill set needs a ton more work. And he's a guy I'm a little bit concerned in the fact that I feel like he hasn't progressed at the same level that he did from his freshman to his sophomore year. Mm-hmm. He has plateaued a little bit, which is a red flag for me. However, I think with, you know, them losing four starters, he will be the only starter returning. Maybe he can have more of a starring role in the offense, and that'll only help his stock next year.
One more for you, Casey, before we let you go. You know, Johnny Dawkins at Stanford really recruited Arizona pretty hard at the high school ranks going into last season, and I don't know how much time you spend around Coach Dawkins or Stanford still, but they brought in guys like Dorian Pickens and Mitch Lightfoot who were stars out here in the Valley, and I'm just curious your thoughts on those two after their freshman seasons and their future at Stanford going forward.
Yeah, well, I did six Stanford games this season, so I saw them a ton, and I watched them on TV whenever I could. And Michael Humphrey, who I believe was from Sunny Slope High School, he hardly played at all in the beginning of the year. But that wasn't because the Stanford coaching staff didn't believe in him. And in actuality, when I went, they were raving about him. But he wasn't physically ready. He still needs probably 20 pounds in the weight room, and he did as soon as he walked on campus his freshman year. But as the season progressed, he got a beating from their starting center, Stefan Nostich, who's a fifth-year senior and just a monster of a dude. So going against him every single day, Michael Humphries really grew. And then finally, when they had some injuries at the front court position in the last several weeks of their season, they inserted Michael Humphries in the starting lineup, and he just took off. So I'm really excited about his growth this year and can't wait to see him next year. Dorian Pickens also got some key playing time at certain spurts of the season. He's got a picturesque jump shot, a very fluid shooting stroke, and he's got good size. So I don't think Stanford's going to be very good next year. I think best case scenario for them, they finish fifth or sixth in the Pac-12. But good news for the young guys from Phoenix is they'll get some playing time.
Absolutely. Casey, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it today. And let's do this again soon, okay?
My pleasure. Have a good day.
Casey Jacobson, former Stanford star, Suns guard, now with Fox Sports 1 as well as Pac-12 Network, joins us here on the show. Really great stuff, and I love his enthusiasm, too. Like, he got me, like, a little bit more fired up in that segment. He brought my level of play up a little bit based on his mentality.
My greatest takeaway was if I, talking to a young person about basketball, start shooting from the 23-24-foot range, and maybe that'll help you down the road.
No question. That's Paula Bovin. I'm Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad Sesmat today. Coming up next on the show, so there was a fight on the south side with a place near and dear to Paula's heart. We'll get into that. And also, staying with baseball, what makes this Diamondbacks team so likable that everyone's talking about them and their ratings are through the roof? That's coming up next on Sports360AZ.com and AZ Central Sports. So we keep getting off track just briefly to talk ASU developments, but you can't help it. They just kind of keep happening. But we'll mention quickly before I pay off the excellent tease I had at the end of the last segment. Shannon Evans, 6'1 point guard, was supposedly going to be headed to Buffalo. Or no, he was on Buffalo last season. This is the guy that Buffalo initially blocked from being able to transfer to ASU. They all ultimately, the athletic director said, never mind. This is bad PR for me. Yeah. He has committed to ASU. He averaged 15 points and 5 assists last year for Buffalo, and credits Bobby Hurley for really everything in his life. He's going to be joining the Sun Devils, and a little point guard battle between him and Trey Holder.
And I think he has to sit out a year, right? So
yes.
It'll be 1 year before he can play, but Hurley clearly feels strongly about him if he's bringing him here. So that's good news for ASU.
No question. So that's news around that. But now let's talk a little baseball. And there's something, the Kansas City Royals, you know, they get to the World Series and now they think they're all that, I guess.
Exactly.
Last weekend they had a a crazy weekend with the Oakland A's that involved Lowry, who slid hard into Alcides Escobar. Escobar got hurt and had to sit maybe two or three games as a result. But it turned into the Royals being relentless in their policing of the game. It had Jed Lowry go right off after the Sunday game and saying it was ridiculous and he didn't know what was going on and he has to do a job. Really validating stuff. So the Royals are at it again. Yordano Ventura, let's see, who was it? It was Adam Eaton.
Adam Eaton,
you know,
right,
former Diamondback, hits a comebacker, a hard one, right at Ventura, and Ventura catches it, and on the way to throwing it to first, starts jawing at Eaton for no reason.
And it was obvious what he said. I mean, it was an expletive.
Very obvious. This is
nice.
A family show, right, so we're not going to talk about what he said. It's the fact that he was saying anything. I've never seen a pitcher get offended for having a comebacker right at him, or if he was taunting. Either way, it started a dugout clearing brawl in the south side of Chicago between the White Sox and the Royals.
As you know, we talked about, I'm a diehard White Sox fan. It's how I grew up, so I blame all of this clearly on the Royals.
Clearly. But actually, I think you're right. It is really the Royals' fault.
Well, and there was some stuff that was happening before that. I think both pitchers had hit batters, and so there's some yapping that started going on. But I think the way he approached Eaton, I mean, he took a couple steps, made sure he could hear him. I know that Eaton barked back at him a little bit, but you're right. It's a very interesting take about the Royals, because they've got a different sort of swagger now because of last season, and not all of it is pretty, I think.
No, not at all. And you wonder now, it brings up a conversation that I feel like is had every year around this time, you know, when baseball's back in full swing and people have had time away from baseball, and then all of a sudden the policing themselves,
yep,
that's the famous line that I think is a joke,
right?
But whatever, stuff like this happens, mm-hmm, they police themselves,
right?
At what point does the MLB have to jump in and say, you know what, this is enough, and we need to start running out suspensions and fines and things of that nature?
Well, and you know, the unwritten rules too is part of this policing yourself. The unwritten rules of, you get hit, then your pitcher comes back and does the same thing. And I've always struggled with this unwritten rules, because there's no rule that says that's what you're supposed to do. But people who grew up in baseball and grew up in that environment say you absolutely have to allow it to be this way. And I don't get any sense from Major League Baseball that they're gonna change anything.
Which is too bad. Now here's another angle to this story. You know, we talked about what happened last night and what happened between Kansas City and Oakland. We saw Toronto and Baltimore. Josie Bats. Bautista hits a home run and really took his sweet time to get around the bases against the Orioles, which led to Bautista and Adam Jones yelling at each other, like verbally through, like at each other from the dugout to center field. There's been a lot of testiness so far in this season. Do you think that there's an element of, you know, there's so much around baseball and trying to appeal to the younger audience and be a little bit more, you know, exciting and captivating and not being boring or with the clock and trying to move quicker? I'm not a conspiracy theorist guy, but do you feel like there's any element, because there's been a lot of this and it's only 3 weeks into the year, to really kind of have baseball really grasp the audience with this drama to start the season, to kind of set the tone for the rest of the year?
It's an interesting take. I don't think I see it from the player's standpoint, but I do see it from the lack of action standpoint with MLB, that it's almost embracing this without saying that's the case. I think it's also, it's part of the high stakes of the game now. The money is so big. You want to perform. If you have a personality, that can lead to Madison Avenue paying attention. It can lead to endorsements. I think that's part of it too, at least from the player standpoint. There's a lot to gain by being successful, much more than it was 20 years ago. The money is just out of the park, so to speak. So I think that's part of it too.
That's Paula Bovin. I'm Jared Cohen, filling in for Brad Sesmat today on a Friday. AZ Central Sports 360 AZ. Let's shift gears to talk baseball locally. And I posed this question to you before the show, and I'm curious your thoughts. The Suns, just everyone has come out and say it just wasn't a likable team this year. And that was before they went into a tailspin at the end of the year. Casey Jacobson last segment talked about it briefly with the technical fouls and the camaraderie not being there like it was. And the everyone loves Jeff Hornacek, and this team obviously isn't playing for him. And then you have this Diamondbacks team that seems to be so far very, very likable. That people are drawn to them. They're getting fantastic ratings. That we see our guy Brett Hansen from Fox Sports Arizona tweeting out these ratings
crazy,
that they've been having.
Right.
What makes this team so likable to that everyone's excited to watch this team? And conversely, the Suns, who just didn't have a likable roster this year.
Yeah, I think it's a couple things. I think one, they're both impacted by what they did the preceding season. The Diamondbacks were awful and not very likable because they were so bad. Now, it's early, but they're kind of exceeding expectations. Goldie's been great. You know, they've got a young pitcher who's drawing a lot of attention. And then you go to the Suns, who overachieved the previous season. Everybody expected so much more, and they fell flat on their face. And they fell flat on their face with a not very likable roster, frankly. I mean, it was hard to embrace the Morris twins. There was, you know, you're seeing players bickering with Hornacek, those kinds of things. So I just think there's a lot of factors involved, but I think some of it has to do just from where they were the year before.
One thing that I want to add to with the Diamondbacks part of things, you hear about prospects and hear about and them coming up the ranks and how they're going to translate. This is a team that basically has an entire roster full of prospects that they've had work up through their own system.
Right.
And I think an element of what's made the team likable slash intriguing is that you have guys like Archie Bradley, Nick Ahmed, Chris Owings, Jake Lamb, AJ Pollock, Inciarte, Peralta, Gosiewicz, all these guys that are homebred, right, homegrown guys.
Sure.
You know, guys that have come up through the system and now are getting their opportunity. And you've heard about them, you've read about them, you've seen the stats they've put on paper. And I think there's an intrigue to see how it all translates. I don't think it's going to translate to them making the playoffs or anything like that. But there's an element of young guys trying to make it on a nightly basis, still competing for spots, even though they've won spots, and guys taking the spots that they've won and trying to flourish in them like a Paul Goldschmidt. You know,
right,
it's not as much a team made up of kind of some retread guys that are trying to fill a big roster with a high payroll like we saw with what Towers did last year, adding guys like Cody Ross. You know, it's a different dynamic.
It's a great point, and I think when you juxtapose the storylines of, you know, Diamondbacks player, I'm totally forgetting his name, who's like in the minors for 10 years and is on the roster now. And
Was it Dorn?
Yeah, Dorn. I mean, storylines like that compared to, you see guys come out of college, out of high school, they make millions immediately, they haven't proven themselves. It's just the way these sports are structured. You're not blaming anybody, but you see them make instant millions. They're not delivering, or they're not, don't seem to be embracing this opportunity given to them. When you read the stories, almost every player in Major League Baseball has taken those long bus rides to small towns and stayed in Motel 6s and had a, you know, $25 per day per diem, and they've had to experience. So I think they even send a vibe of gratefulness that may not even be intentional. And I think as fans, you feel it.
Where do you see Yasmani Tomas in the future of this team? Because right now his role seems to be up in question. He's going to get some shot at third base with Jake Lamb being out.
Right.
What do you see him fitting in with this team and the make of it? And what's made it so likable, to kind of go with our topic here, where do you see him all fitting in with
that? Well, and what's so interesting to me is what I'm hearing from the organization is I don't think it's resolved, Jared. I think it's still kind of a work in progress of putting him in different places and just seeing where it fits. I don't think they've made a clear-cut decision of what's going to happen with this guy.
So you're a White Sox fan. Who's your least favorite Cub of all time?
Ron Santo, probably.
Ron Santo.
I know that's sacrilegious, but
The
beloved Cub, but he was so... He did so many good things and drew so much attention in the newspapers. I was jealous. That was all.
Yeah, that's all. That's all. Mark Grace? You know, where does Mark Grace stack up?
You know, I've gotten to know Mark, and he's actually a decent, very decent fellow. So I've sort of forgiven him and think of him as a Diamondback.
Good stuff. Good stuff. That's Paula Bovin of AZ Central Sports. I'm Jared Cohen. We're filling in for Brad today. We're going to switch gears next segment, switching from sports to talk little movies and entertainment. Bill Goody Koontz joins us next, AZ Central Chief chief film and media critic for his weekly segment. He got to talk to Russell Crowe. I know someone who's tuning into the show right now is a big fan of Russell Crowe. So we'll get to hear what he had to say in that experience. That's all coming up next.
For original, in-depth Arizona sports news you care about, follow us on Twitter at Sports360AZ.
We do it every week on the Brad Sesmatt Show. Bill Goodykoots, AZ Central chief film and media critic, joins the show so we can talk a little movies and entertainment and not just sports. But I've got to ask you, Bill, off the top, is there anything out there in the entertainment world that is more exciting and dramatic than Steph Curry these days?
There is not.
Is there anything even close?
One of the reasons I love Steph Curry is because I went to high school with his mom.
Oh, wow.
Get out of here.
There's a fun fact for the show.
And she was a volleyball player. And the thing that is interesting, and this kind of happened with him from college. You know, he was a really good college player, but he's a great pro. In high school, she was a good volleyball player, but she ended up getting a scholarship to Virginia Tech, which is where she met Dell, which is, you know, now they have Steph. Mm-hmm. And she really blossomed as a volleyball player. But you know, you used to see her particularly during the NCAA tournament when he was at Davidson, when they were. You know, they'd always show her over there, and she wasn't loud and crazy like that when I knew her. But
like she is now.
But, yeah, and she's also Paul has heard me talk, well, yeah, too, about my buddy Michael Young, who's the head basketball coach at Wofford College. Well, another buddy of ours who we've all played basketball with is a guy named Steve Snell, and he's the assistant basketball coach at Air Force, and he is cousins with Steph, and with Steph's mom, and so whatever that makes him to second. So the people in Bradford, Virginia, where I'm from, even though the Currys are not from there, they're from a different part of Virginia. I think that, like, because of them, because of Sonia, his mom, I think we've all kind of adopted Steph as, and now everybody else has. So
yeah, the whole world, pretty much. Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, my 16-year-old daughter keeps wanting me to somehow parlay this into, can we meet him? Can we meet him? I've never met him in my life. I don't, you know. I haven't talked to Sonia since 12th grade. So I think it's doubtful, you know. But I think just watching that last night, but didn't you know that was going to happen? I mean, wasn't there like part of you? He missed the first shot, and as soon as they got the offensive rebound, which evidently they didn't have any trouble getting, they got 10 in the fourth quarter, but it comes back to him, and it's like, you know that thing is going in.
No, yeah, I question.
Mean, it's just But the thing that I'm really starting to like about him more is not just his shooting there, but he's doing some of those, you know, pretty cool, like, you know, Pete Maravich type passes and stuff. Doesn't he kind of remind you? This is probably not a good parallel, but kind of like a better Nash. Nash is pretty great.
He's a more flashy Nash. That's for sure. They do a lot of similar things, though, but I feel like he's a little bit more flashy and
right.
Exciting type. But there's definitely an element of comparison right there.
And works on his craft. You know, we've been talking to people as much as anybody in the NBA, and people who have worked on their craft include Russell Crowe. And I have to tell you, Goody, my 86-year-old mother, I hope she doesn't mind mentioning the age, is here in the room right now, and she is like a... She has a Russell Crowe poster in her apartment. I'm not kidding. It's a little creepy, frankly. But she loves Russell Crowe. There's Russell Crowe poster and Napoleon right next to it. She'd love to know what he was like in person, because didn't you have a sit-down with him?
It was not a sit-down. It was a phone call.
Yeah. What did you think of him?
He's not that nice a guy. He's a great actor. And he's brilliant. I mean, the way he was talking about movies and stuff, it's like, whoa. You know, it's funny because my same 16-year-old star-struck daughter, she wanted to listen in because, well, he's famous, right? And I
said, yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, you don't have the hookup with Steph Curry, but you have it with Russell Crowe. That's a pretty solid trade-off.
And at the end of this thing, I was like, I looked, and she had, like, her Vine open or whatever, her Snapchat. And there's, like, me talking to Russell Crowe on the phone. And I said, did you tape that? And she said, well, yeah, you said he was famous. And I was like, well, so you taped me taping him.
That's funny.
That's cool, though.
But he's one of these guys, like, and she thought he was very rude. But he's one of these guys, and when I was typing back the transcript, you know, he said, this is going to be a long answer, Bill. Are you ready for a long answer? And I was like, yeah, sure. And so I asked him about, like, how he comes to this movie, why he wants this to be his directing debut. And he goes on for, you know, longer than most people do for these kind of things, and then he pauses. And so I start up with another question. I I wanted to ask about Gallipoli, the movie, the great movie that Mel Gibson was in back in like 1980 or whatever. And he says, yeah, he says, well, he says, you've cut me off about a third of the way through my answer. I'd like to go back and answer the full thing if that's all right with you.
Oh, God. I've heard that about him, though, yeah.
And I look at my daughter, and she's just like, and, you know, I ended up writing something yesterday because the Avengers junket tour has been running into all these things where, you know, Robert Downey Jr. got up and walked out of an interview with a British guy because he wanted to ask him about his past. And I think it wasn't talking about his past that bothered him. I think it was more the way the guy did it. Because I've talked to Robert Downey Jr. before, and he doesn't, I mean, he'll talk about whatever. I mean, partly I think it's how you get him to talk about it. But then Chris Evans and Jeremy Renner called Black Widow a slut and a whore.
And okay.
And completely joking, you know. And by the way, they are talking about a fictional character. But they weren't calling Scarlett Johansson. They were saying, like, you know, a lot of fans want to see her hook up with, you know, like, one of your characters or something like that. And they're like, she's a slut. Oh, yeah, she's a whore or something. But so they're in trouble for that. But this thing that I wrote was, and it's not a whole lot different than, you know, a post-game press conference. The worst, the one thing that whether it's a basketball team, a football team, a movie studio, whoever it is, the biggest goal they have is to not create a story. They want it quiet, you know. And it's sort of like, you know, it's a business transaction. I'm getting something from them. They're getting something from me. It's the same with sports. The parallel has always struck me because when I used to work in sports, I used to talk to Charles Barkley all the time, and people would say, "Oh, are you friends with him?" And I'm like, "No, I'm not friends with him. He knows that I have a pencil in my hand and a piece of paper, and I'm going to ask him a question, and he's going to answer it, and then." He goes and talks to somebody else, and I go do my thing. And I think that people sometimes get the wrong impression. They think some people you kind of become friends with. You're around them long enough, or you certainly admire them. But you always have to have that distance and that disconnect. If they do something wrong, you got to write about it. I mean, you're not going to hide it because you know them or you like them. I mean, nobody's off limits. And I think that happens here. And I think that what Russell Crowe kind of does is, you know, like these guys from the Avengers does. He kind of makes news, you know, and I think it makes him uncomfortable, but I do believe it makes for a better story.
Bill Giddykoontz joins us here on the Brad Sesmatch Show. He does each and every week. Can you talk about, have you been able to screen or see the movie, was it The Water Diviner? Is that the new movie that he has coming out? And what were your thoughts on that? I thought that looks like a really interesting, intriguing concept about having a parent having children at war and the search to see if they're alive in that time and things of that nature.
Well, it's really solid. It reminded me a lot of I say this as a compliment, an old-fashioned movie.
Sure.
You know, like something that you would have seen, like some big war epic in the 60s, where it falters, and the war part is good. What's happened is his three sons went to battle, and as far as they know, they were all killed on the same day, the Battle of Gallipoli. So he's a water diviner. You can find water. Evidently, that means you can also find dead people. His wife has kind of gone crazy, and she's like, "You can find water, but you can't find our sons. Can't you bring them back and bury them?" Da da da. Well, the problem is, you know, like 10,000 people or something died at the Battle of Gallipoli. So there, and so he goes, the movie gets kind of bogged down in this just very unconvincing romance, and that kind of slows things down. But he's a good director, man. And I mean, it's a great looking movie. He's got all that, you know, I don't know if they really filmed it in Turkey, but it looks really nice. And, you know, I would love to ask him a little more about, you know, do you want to try something else? Do you want to try a comedy or whatever? But as it turns out, it just was not that kind of conversation.
Yeah, he sounds like it can be challenging at times for discussions with him. Did you see the movie? And I think it is Ex Machina, the movie that's out? And just your thoughts on that. It sounded interesting.
It's fabulous. It's great. It's this guy... Tom Hall Gleason, who's in a lot of stuff, he's like a, you know, a computer coder at this massive company called Blue Book, which is like Google, except that they do 90% of the world searches or whatever. And so it's founded by this guy whose compound is so big, he's a recluse, that they're flying in a helicopter to get him there because he wins this contest. He gets to spend a week with him. And he says, "When are we going to get to his property?" And he says, "Well, we've been flying over his property for 2 hours." And I mean, that's how big guys compound is. So it's Oscar Isaac, who was in inside Llewyn Davis in a lot of movies. He's a really good actor. And he has created these robots, kind of one at a time. He gets rid of them when he's done with them. But he's trying to create artificial intelligence or AI, you know. And there's a saying, if you remember Alan Turing from The Imitation Game, well, the actual Imitation Game is called the Turing Test. And what you do is, if you sit down with them and you can't tell they're a robot, it passes the Turing Test. That means it has consciousness. It's like a person. So he wants him to sit down and do this with this robot. And the robot turns out to be, of course, he builds a beautiful woman robot. He just like sits in his place all by himself and drinks all the time. But he develops this relationship with this robot, and you don't know what their motives really are. And it's just, it's really creepy and really, really cool looking and really smart. I mean, I really liked it. That's one of my favorite movies of the year.
Good stuff, Bill. Thank you so much for your time. As always, we appreciate it, and I look forward to catching up next week as well.
All right, thanks.
Great. That's AZ Central Chief Film and Media Critic Bill Goodykoontz joins us here on the Brad Sesmet Show each and every week. And always a fun fact with him. I remember the last time I did the show, he talked about his Wofford Terriers connection. It was right around the NCAA tournament. And now we find out that he went to high school with Steph Curry's mom. So it's always something new with Bill.
And
keep up.
Right. And there's always some little sports segment now we'll have to do with him. All his connections.
Yeah, his sports team connections. He's got a connection with everyone, it seems
exactly
like. So that Ex Machina movie, yeah. I'm totally bad at pronouncing things like that. It looks really creepy.
Yeah, it does, but sounds really good and kind of unique. So
very, very interesting. I'm going to check. Have you seen the Divergent series movies? Have you seen the
first
one?
Yeah, I saw the first one. Loved it.
I might be checking the second one out because we loved the first one, too. My wife and I, we might be checking the second one out this weekend. We don't get to movies very often, you know.
Little kids.
It's not very easy, but we might have an opportunity this weekend, and that's a movie that I think we're going to check. I love that first one.
That first one, it was just so original. And
surprising.
I
didn't expect it to be as good as it was.
And it's hard to be surprised by movies anymore because everything has been covered. So I agree with it. Well, let me know how that one is before I'll go check it out.
I will. Absolutely. Paula Bovin, AZ Central Sports. I'm Jared Cohen. We filled in for Brad Sesmat today on the show. All sorts of good stuff. You can hear us back. We got the podcast in Sports 360 AZ. We had great interviews with Casey Jacobson as well as Bill. Bill Goodykoontz joins us each and every week. A lot of good stuff there. We'll also have more stuff on the site. And Paula, great stuff again on the Brittany Griner piece. It was a great read, and I appreciate you taking the step forward to get that out there.
Appreciate that, Jared. Thank you.
Of course. That's Paula. I'm Jared, filling in for Brad once again on Sports 360 AZ and AZ Central Sports. Have a good weekend.